I prepared a 3-hour message that I had to condense to an hour and a half. Now I got to do it in 55 minutes. 52 minutes. Well, that was the first hour. They're on the board. You have a book in front of you. 6 pages. We're camping out on mankind's foolishness, so 6 is a good number. Romans 1:21. D.O.T. Because, nontes, having known, ton theon, the God, previous verse saying he was revealed in the creation. I don't have to spend much time on that today. God's talking through his word, and he's satisfied. He is satisfied that he has left enough marks of his presence, fingerprints, footprints, handiwork, that he can hold all mankind accountable. If they don't recognize he is, his supreme power for having made all this, sense his worth, be aware of his reality, and thankful. His wrath now, not in the future, now, is poured out by the removal of something that all mankind has, insight. He makes their hearts senseless, no longer having the capacity to see him if he knocked them down. Hearts being darkened, the next verses will say, turned over to a strong delusion, believing a lie and being damned because they worship the creature instead of the Creator, starting with themselves as a creature. He punishes them now. He withdraws from them a capacity to see him. Makes their hearts senseless. Next verses say, turns them over to a strong delusion. They'll be unaware of it. There won't be any conviction. They're turned over to a strong delusion. They'll believe a lie and be damned. And their practices will reveal the vacancy. Their practice will show forth and give evidence of a senseless heart in the sense of sense capacity to know and see and be aware of God. And their talkings and dialogues, the word, if you look at it, translated reasoning, their reasonings, their thought patterns, and their dialogues will be self-deceptively evil. That's the verse. I'm not a scientist. I didn't even do my doctorate in science. Did it in philosophy. Stanford was good to let me cross-fertilize, and I originally intended to go to Cal, so I had to prepare for a doctorate in geography, which required a unit major in geology, so I have some foundation in geology, a minor in the physical sciences, but I'm not a scientist. And the purpose of these messages is not to turn this church into a science classroom, but by looking at those that have absolutely refused to consider God as part of the equation. Some of them on record, the Huxleyites in particular, we must not let the concept of God get a foot in the door, is the way one of them puts it. God is viewed as the creation of a mind that is to be scorned and contemptuously put in its place. Ignorance created God. God didn't create man. Man created God to fill in the gaps of his ignorance. Or as the applier of scientism, and particularly Darwinism with a revolutionary twist to society, Karl Marx, it's that God's the opiate of the people. A drug. I had Melissa pull out of the internet last night for me an article entitled The God Module, where they have discussed at a neuroscientist convention recent studies with epileptics. They're always trying to put anything regarding God in the nutty fringe. But the studies have begun to hint to a section in the, I think it's the frontal lobe of the brain, that apparently has an influence on the intensity of religious reactions and thought and activity. And, of course, the evolutionists have said, immediately they must grab an explanation. This is an advanced evolutionary development designed to cope with the frictions of society, enabling man to project and create a God concept as a tool to control and protect against the excesses of society. And those who believe in God seize on it on the other side of the spectrum as proof that God placed in all mankind this unique capacity to be religious. And the evolutionists say a mutational aberration of this religious tendency is what produces epileptics and seizures who get really religious. Scorn. Is that a siren or a ring in my... Well, the current society would probably send the cops to get somebody saying Darwinism is not true. So the religious urge, you see where it's going to lead you, folks. The extreme aberration. I've never discussed it because I sure don't want to be put in any category like Timothy O'Leary. I think that's his name. Who's the guy that was in LSD?
Timothy Leary.
That's what I said. Timothy Leary. On the brilliant man on the screwball fringe is the way he has been viewed. But even Houston Smith reported some profound medically supervised LSD experiments in his book Forgotten Truths in Europe, conducted over a long period of time under controlled situations with diverse elements in the population. Not an exception. And the reason I hesitate to get on it is I don't want to in any way suggest, particularly having been in the Bay Area, in the Berkeley area, during that Hyde-Ashbury and Berkeley riot period and acid heads galore, that there is any experimentation that should be done. I think it's been established pretty much that there is permanent damage to the brain that can occur with LSD, in addition to the sometimes very extreme activity that has led to death, like jumping out windows and other things. But there are, if you get Houston Smith's book, Forgotten Truths, in the appendix, there's a report on medically supervised experiments in Europe over a long period of time with subjects of every sociological background, from criminal types to agnostics to atheists to religious, not an exception. I mean, these are phased experiments, not just a dabbling with LSD, but phased experiments, probably illegal in the United States, conducted in Europe, that lead through successive stages. And those that go to the final stage, without an exception, have religious experiences as they turn inward into the mind, and ever after, regardless of their particular previous religious orientation, they're ever after religious. They have experiences related to God when they get through the layers of the conscious mind and personality so affected and imprisoned by the tunnel that we live in, that when you get into that deep subconscious, they come out religious. Again, take both sides. Connect it to what I said about the God module. Humankind represents the only worshiping life on this planet that can be found. You will never find fossilized worship centers among animals and so-called predecessors to mankind. Those who believe in God believe He breathed into them His image. He put something in man that enables man, indeed, initially makes mankind worshipful. That's why Jesus says, recognizing what society does, except you become as a child. You're not much trouble getting children to sing Jesus loves me. That I know. Culture and society in the tunnel suppresses, erases, and scars over. That's going beyond Romans 1:20. I'll return to it when we get into the second chapter of Romans, where God, through Paul, is pointing out you're without excuse because God has written in the heart the capacity to respond to Him. What this verse is saying, resistance to that, refusal to see or even allow the possibility of the outside Creator's existence, power and worship Him, is to cause God to get so mad, orgy, that He pulls away that God consciousness, that God recognition, that God worshiping ability. And you become evil in a self-deceptive sense. Now, we've been in a lot of science, but I'm going to take one word here. Became vain is the translation on Romans 1:21, that first piece of paper you have, hematiotheson. The root word, matthios. I read to you briefly from the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament what matthios in its root meaning is saying. Can I take you there again?
Yes,
write some notes on it. It's a word regarding action or thought or reasonings or dialogues which does not rest on the causes which it alleges, but are deceptive. There's always the implication of what is against the norm, unexpected, offending what ought to be, worthless because deceptive or ineffectual. The New Testament is in the Greek language, but as I've pointed out to you many times, as we trace the origins of the word faith and other words, before Christ's coming, using the Roman numeral 7 to designate Septuagint, because the legends have it that Ptolemy, ruler of Egypt, building a great library, asked for 70 scholars to come down and translate the Hebrew scriptures. And between, if you remove the legend, between 300 B.C. and 100 B.C., the Old Testament was translated into Greek, called the Septuagint. And the Septuagint was the Bible of the New Testament church. And the Bible that the gospel writers and Paul usually and Jesus quoted when they're in the New Testament in Greek reading a passage, they're reading from the Septuagint. So the Septuagint becomes a clue. As the Old Testament unfolds in this Greek language, for Old Testament word meanings, and vice versa, the Old Testament, which enfolds the New, becomes a clue to the meaning of the Greek word pulled out of general Greek culture and used to translate the Old Testament. There were, as this dictionary says, there were a host of Hebrew words relating to emptiness, meaninglessness, self-deception, vain, perverse, like a whole basket of Hebrew words waiting, like there were many Hebrew words translated by pisteo, various nuances of the words faith that we've spent so much time on, running to a shelter, leaning on something, camping therein, and being in a settled state, amen to God, all with his tail. Matthias is used to translate a host of Hebrew words that have this meaning of self-deception, vanity, emptiness, foolish. But the most frequent, Hebel. H-B-L is a sort of oversimplified transliteration. So I grabbed the Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament. It's just now really coming out. I think the 11th volume, that's quite a ways down in the alphabet, has just been produced. Because I just got it in the mail, so it must have just come out. I decided I'd check this word that more than any other words, Hebel, is used as a basket of meaning that carries into the New Testament and is translated by this word that is now being described by Paul, God's spokesman, as the state of mind that the continued removal of God from the equation results in is God makes your mind senseless and pulls the God capacity out. Your mind and you become Hebel. What does that word mean? Well, hot air, warm breath or breeze, vapor. You like that? That's the first thing I see here for the word. 73 times in the Masoretic text. Hot air, warm breath, vapor. To do vainly, vanity, dust, dirt, vanity, vapor, breath, vapor, breath, wind. There was even an old Arabic pre-Islamic deity called Hubal. Wind, from a poem of the 6th century. Arabic has symbolic vapor. The verb haba, to blow. I like that. To blow, blowhards. Gust of wind, fine dust, soot, violent wind, place where the wind blows, mirage. That's what they become. And that's why the 22nd verse is so important. Professing themselves to be wise, sophists, sophisticated, they become, if you look at the word as it's pronounced, you have the root of our word moron. They become morons. And all with the removal of a divine given capacity to recognize and worship God and thank Him as you explore His wonderful universe, they become self-deceived blowhards. Habala, to babble and chatter. Empty, emptiness, vanity. Nothing. Deceit, falsehood. Deceit, falsehood, to have no value, to be good for nothing. Emptiness. It's a one of a group of words, tohu, reach, sheker, shav, and oven, which means vanity, wind, condensed expressions, synonymous with vanity and striving after wind. In Deuteronomy, it's with a group of words for idols. Falsehood, deception, emptiness, vanity, vanity, worthlessness, no God. The name of the deity, Hubal, connected with this usage and originally meant something like a cult mystery in the Canaanite nature rite, worshiping of nature. In the book of Ecclesiastes, the word is taken over to denote worthlessness, darkness, feeding on the wind, striving and straining after wind. It forces upon Hebel the special sense of that which does not counter matter. No, vain, that which yields no results. A devaluation of the system of norms established by traditional wisdom, a polemic against its sensible value regulations, a defamation of the wisdom ideal for life. All of that is involved. It proves to be an effective catchword that extends to those values into the grotesque, the mental figure, breath, exaggeration, contrast, and monotonous repetition. That's what God puts on. That's what He puts on a person. That's what His present wrath is. They become Matthias, Hebel, in their reasonings, their dialogues, and their senseless heart. Darkened. You find yourself as you study, I went through the physics books, you find yourself studying and standing in awe at the mental capacities of these men. And you have to ask yourself, why is God not even worthy of consideration? I feel guilty that I'm being easier than God. God has no tolerance for not being recognized. I'm asking myself, why is God ruled out? And the only explanation is R.C. Sproul's. They resent God's sovereignty. They don't want to bow before Him. They do worship the creature themselves. more than the creation. They don't want to recognize their inadequacy in front of Him. They are self-made men who worship their creation. That's why. And then God takes the capacity away, and professing to be wise with all this foolish babble, they become fools. I ordered books for the bookstore. They were supposed to be here by this week. Hopefully they'll be here next week. I want the parents to have Icons of Evolution available here. Shattering the Myths of Darwinism by Richard Milton. And an attorney in our congregation sent me someone he obviously admires who is an attorney. I already had the set, in fact, ordered most of them for the bookstore. But I can always use duplicate copies in the different locations that I go. Of course, there's scorn and put-downness on the part of scientists for anyone who believes in God. Well, those of us that do are not all fools. Last time I checked, Stanford's right up there. And I got a message last week. Some of you may have heard it on festival. A little brag time for God's glory. Paul once said, everybody else is being a fool, so let me be one for a while. And he began to outline his credentials that surpassed his critics who were playing the fool and expecting him to be humble and not tell anybody what a fool he was not. So he said, I'm going to outfool them. So these fools that would have you believe, in fact, the writer here, Milton. I'm going slow because I got so much time today. Richard Milton, member of Mensa, that's all you need. Nobody but geniuses get into Mensa. Yet this book, when it was published, which maybe is one of the finest and best written, because he's also a science writer. And you have to be pretty confident to be a science writer, as the lady for the Times who wrote the book about nothing. One of the best on the subject of the newly discovered reality of nothing. Richard Milton, when he publishes this book, or writes against Darwinism, has the leading high priest, along with Gould, the leading high priest and spokesperson of Darwinism, Richard Dawkins, characterized the book as loony, stupid, dribble, and its author as a harmless fruitcake who needs psychiatric help. When you can't match the argument, you argue to the man. That's what you run into. And to think that all of these people are second-rate citizens. Philip E. Johnson, perhaps the most effective spokesperson running loose today against Darwinism, graduated from Harvard and the University of Chicago Law School. He was a law clerk for Chief Justice Earl Warren of the United States Supreme Court and taught law for more than 30 years at the University of California, Berkeley. Darwin on trial, reason in the balance, defeating Darwinism by opening minds and objections sustained, and his most recent, The Wedge of Truth, which I will refer to today, God willing, as I move along in the message. Don't get the idea that to not embrace Darwinism makes you a second-class intellectual product. It's that scorn and that put-downness that I fought all through my years gaining a PhD in philosophies of education at Stanford University. still right up there, last time I checked, as a major university. Darwinism is the subject where we ended last week. We ended reading, or we ended a message that had started with reading some newspaper articles, including Front Page Times, Front Page USA Today, Find in Kenya confounds the belief in a single early ancestral species. Throwing the origins of humankind into question, researchers in Kenya, Niveliki, unearthed the battered but almost complete skull of a new human species. Not even debatable. A new human species with a surprisingly delicate face dating from 3.5 million years ago. Now it's from volcanic ash in an area that used to be called Lake Rudolph, a tough T-U-F-F deposit that allegedly has been dated by potassium-argon methods that fixed the date at 3.6 million years. This is where I'm going to concentrate today in the few minutes I have. You have a geologic column as the third page. I gave you that last Sunday. And I pointed out with the little diagram to the right that the era that is being focused on, the geologic column assumes the Earth is now just taken as a fact. The Earth to be 4,600,000,000 years old. And that's just fact. It's no longer even taught as theory. It's fact. And the period of life is such a small part of that 4,600,000,000 years. And I pulled this out of the computer. The classic analogy for illustrating the relative duration of parts of the geologic time scale, look at the little diagram I drew to the right. Imagine that all the Earth's history is laid out on a yardstick. Recall that the original measure of the yard was the distance from the king's nose to the tip of his finger. It's like early measurements had to do with hands and length from elbow to fingertip. The yard was from the tip of the king's nose to his finger. That's the way you measured a yard. And that was the authoritative measuring device. Now you could hope that you bought things when the king was short-nosed and long-armed and sold it when the king was long-nosed and short-armed, because it changed with the ruler. But in any event, if 1 yard represents, by that standard, all of geologic time, then 1 swipe of a nail file across the tip of the king's finger will remove all of human history. We're gone. Does that put it in perspective for you? If the earth is that old, it's heresy in the tunnel. They probably will bury you under the foundation. It's heresy in the tunnel to even consider that the earth might not be that old. And that maximum amount of time is not available for evolution to work. Because you see, evolution has 2 basic principles. One, it borrowed from geology. Charles Lyell, considered the father of modern geology, was the tutor of Darwin in geologic matters. His basic principle, uniformitarianism. Up until Lyell began to crack it, Currie the French paleontologist, and the world generally considered the history of the earth to be a series of cataclysms, wipeouts and startovers, cataclysms. And the biblical view, I'm not there yet, but the biblical view is cataclysms. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Period. Period. And go to Isaiah, where it says He created it not a waste and a desolation. I can go to Jeremiah, where He sees the earth when there was no man. Yet there were meeting places, called cities in the King James, but literally, meeting places of intelligent beings. We know that Satan was in Ezekiel and Isaiah. Find Satan in Eden before he fell. Jesus saw him cast out. War in the heavens. Third of heaven followed him. Genesis 1:2. And the earth became a waste and a desolation. I find general inconsistencies that bother me because even the evolutionists and the geologic column recognize the postulation that the dinosaurs were wiped out with a great collision. Some giant stellar unit hitting this earth, creating such a dust cloud, it totally interrupted the food chain, and that wiped out the dinosaurs and the Ammonites. They accept that cataclysm. But historically, five great mass extinctions of cataclysms. The Bible certainly talks quickly of two. The first one, and the earth became a waste and a desolation. And the flood, that's a cataclysm, where the earth is starved. There's magnetic evidence in the rocks that the pole has changed at times. There are good arguments for the earth having inverted its poles at some time. Geology has moved on until it's hardly to be contested anymore of the drifting and shifting of continental plates. And one scientist says, history will one day look back and see evolution as another religion of the 20th century that fell to the wayside. We're not there yet. Right now it is the religion of the tunnel. And it's heresy to oppose it. And it requires constancy, uniform. The key, stated in the words of one of them, the key to the past is the present. An extension beyond what Sagan said, this cosmos is all there is and all there ever was and all there ever will be. The geologic premise, one of five settled at the Supreme Court level when they were rendering a decision about religion and schools and separation of church and state, uniformitarianism. Everything must have proceeded as it now proceeds at a fixed rate, going along as it goes now, constant, and thus lots of time necessary for evolution to unfold. Lots of time. And the way it unfolds in that massive time scale that is now adjudged to be 4,600,000,000 years is by random mutations, though genetics show that mutations generally and by an overwhelming majority, downgrade and denigrate. And where mutations produce visible results in experiments, they're freaks usually. Mutations degenerate, but random mutations that are positive create a change enabling the randomly mutated by chance alone, species to have better survival ability, and thus it lives on, and those with less survival ability die out. So these random mutations by chance and natural selection or survival of the fittest and capacity to endure because of the random mutational change, in 4,600,000,000 years makes evolution possible. Well, let's look. I haven't got time for everything today, but let's just look at one. Okay? Miller does a good job with this. How old is the earth? On the face of it, the answer to this question is cut and dried, no longer relevant to a discussion of evolution. It seems irrelevant to the modern debate because the age now universally accepted for the earth is so vast, 4,600,000,000 years, as to allow life to evolve not once, but many times. And hang on to these expanded. I've expanded the geologic column into a 3-page one that follows that. So just hang on to it. If I don't get to it today, bring it back with you next Sunday. I didn't print as many of those, so hang on to them. The age now universally accepted, 4,600,000,000 years, allows life to have evolved not once but many times. But let's use our imagination. Does an age of 4,600,000,000 years really provide enough time for evolution to have worked along Darwinian lines? Even more outrageous, what if the earth is not as old as we think? Try this thought experiment on the first question. What has to happen for life to get started in the primeval oceans . How many of you remember this opening to just demonstrate how the media supports scientism? How many of you remember this scene? Accompanied by music from Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, I read it to you a couple of weeks ago, the primordial earth seethes with volcanic activity, red-hot lava flows over the land and tumbles into the sea, generating clouds of steam while lightning flashes in the sky above. Slowly the camera pans down until it reaches the calm depths of the ocean, where mysterious specks glow in the dark. Suddenly a single-celled animal darts across the screen. Life is born! The scene is from Walt Disney's 1940 film classic, Fantasia, and the narrator calls it a coldly accurate reproduction of what science thinks went on during the first few billion years of this planet's existence. Well, okay. We got 4,600,000,000 years. Now, what has to happen for life to get started? First, inner chemicals must form spontaneously amino acids. Now, we've already covered from Icons of Evolution by Wells the Miller-Urey experiment, which is shown in every textbook, where it is claimed that the formation of amino acids from the atmosphere spontaneously is proven, and which they set up an experiment where gases are put in a series of tubes and expanded areas within it, closed compartments, and they must make very sure that they remove all the oxygen, because the air has to go out with no oxygen because the mixture has methane gas, among other things. And then they send an electrical spark, once the air is removed, to simulate lightning hitting the early Earth atmosphere, and they produced the most basic, primitive amino acid, and hailed it as proof that that's how life was formed spontaneously in the early atmosphere of the Earth. Now, if they hadn't removed the oxygen when they hit the electrical spark, as I said 2 weeks ago, it would have been the last act they took. It would have blown them up. And they therefore postulate what's called a reductionist atmosphere, in contrast to an atmosphere with oxygen, which oxidizes. There must be an atmosphere with no oxygen. This is what they have to postulate for their experiment to work, otherwise everything blown up. No oxygen in the atmosphere of the early Earth. The only problem with it is all the geologic record back to the oldest shows oxidization, oxidizing. Every geologic record and every other approach to it proves that there was always oxygen from the earliest to the present. So the Miller-Urey experiment's out the window. But let's assume two things. They argue, well, we're here, and that was the atmosphere that was necessary for first life to be born. Ergo, that's what was there, because that's what had to be there for it to happen, which is arguing in a circle. Let's assume they're right. That was the atmosphere. No oxygen. And let's assume that out of that soup, primordial soup, the first amino acid formed. Okay? And let's say Miller-Urey's right, because that's what had to be, and amino acids did form, therefore it must have been an oxygen-free atmosphere. Let's give them that, okay? All right, the next step. Amino acids, once they're formed, must combine to form the stuff of life, protein molecules. Now, protein molecules, to a source that's available to all of you, occupies hosts of pages in Encyclopedia Britannica. Look at it. Complicated. Here's a little sample of the chains of protein molecules, the way they can form. Try to get that. It's chains of molecules. Protein molecules. And they have to form something even more complicated, which is self-replicating, self-reproducing, and self-governed identity of duplication. But let's say these molecules from amino acids are going to form. And then after that second step, there has to be from self-replicating to self-replicating cellular bodies, and ultimately then to the molecular structure that produces everything from bacteria to Beethoven. Well, that's got to happen. We got 4,600,000,000 years, okay? Stay with me now. Steps 2 and 3 are the problem. Step 2. We've accepted Miller-Urey. And we're going to agree for purposes of discussion on that which is not proven, indeed, is proven not to be, that it was an oxygen-free atmosphere, okay? Now, all I want you to see is Romans 1:20, a completely turned-over brain that will die a fool rather than make room for God, that will conceive of anything, however ridiculous, much more ridiculous than the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Let's just go forward. We're going to accept Miller-Urey. So the amino acids are here. So a little chunk of 4,600,000,000, let's say the first day. Now we got 1 day less than 4,600,000,000. Except that won't work either, because you're going to see that. Step two, the spontaneous formation of protein molecules, which are the necessary building blocks of life. Now, Darwinists don't like to talk about a biogenesis, how you get from inanimate chemical structures to life. But let's assume we made this big jump. Spontaneous formation of protein molecules, an unknown process. Never been demonstrated, never been shown how it happens. But with computers, they have figured out it's theoretically possible. And they have assessed on computers by every possible mixture of the building blocks that produce the molecule of proteins. They have been able to figure out a probability. Murray Eden, professor of electrical engineering at MIT, on the basis of the size and complexity of such molecules, has calculated that a very simple synthesis of a protein molecule would be expected to happen by chance once in a billion years. That's the chance. Once in a billion years. Even these very lengthy odds can be accommodated by 4,600,000,000. It's only using up one of the billions. We still got 3,000,000,006. Okay? Assuming the amino acids were there right to start. But life is not, let's look a little closer. Life's not spontaneously emerging today. This is attributed by Darwinists to the fact that conditions have changed since life evolved in the archaic oceans. How long then exactly? Because it's not happening today. So today must be, even now they got to go back on the key to the past is the present. And it's not happening in oceans today. So there's must have been a time when it was different, when this could happen. So when could that time have been, and how long exactly were the conditions available for this spontaneous forming of proteins? The time available would be bounded by two events. Two events set your calendar. The time on the lower end, the cooling of the earth, and the establishing of oceans from its formation out of vaporized gas and hot earth, it had to cool enough for oceans to form in the evolutionary and geologic frame. And that time is marked, and it's marked clearly, because you must have an ocean before you have sedimentary rocks. So the first sedimentary rocks give you the date when the earth cooled enough, an ocean formed for rocks, primary rocks, to wash down and form sedimentary rock. And these sedimentary rocks, by the same methods, which I'm going to challenge, not today, but in a later message, are dated various ways, fossils, radiocarbon, ain't no fossils back there, 4.6 million, but 4.6 billion. But the various methods of dating dates the first sedimentary rocks, the oldest ones are found up in Greenland. And they're dated 3,800,000,000. Okay? Now we've narrowed it. And the other end of the calendar, upper marker is the date of the first fossil of a living thing. Because the proteins had to form, and living things come out of it and leave a fossil evidence. So from the first sedimentary rock, 3,800,000,000 by their own dating scale, to the first living fossil, or fossils of living creatures, and that's dated at 3,200,000,000. So the period of time for proteins to spontaneously form, of which the chance of it happening by chance, which is the method of Darwinism, is 1 in 1 billion. Now, the conservative date for the first fossils, which are Eobacterium isolatum and Archaeospheroid barbatonensis, are dated from 3,200,000,000 years ago. This means we have a window between 3.8 and 3.2. Have you followed that? So the time available is 600,000,000 years. And the chance is 1 in 1 billion. But actually the gap's smaller. But this crude sum, because it takes considerable time for the new oceans that put down sediments, the new oceans to form. the right mixture of basic chemicals to make the primeval soup. And the bacteria must have been predated by some simpler non-replicating molecules of which no trace survives. So it would be cut down from 600 million. But let's give them a break. Let's build the whole 600 million. Okay? And that interval must accommodate not only the spontaneous combination of amino acids, but the movement into protein molecules, one in a billion, and the evolution into self-replicating cellular bodies, and the second step is by chance one in a billion. So of the 4,600,000,000, we have less than 600 million. But all of a sudden, in the fossil, or in the oldest rocks in Greenland, they discovered some fossils in 1979. Studying the oldest known sedimentary rocks from Greenland, said to date from 3.8 billion years ago, geologist Hans Ploug and H. Jeske Boyer found fossil-like structures in 1979, which they named Isopherla. These fossils are a primitive yeast-like organism, and in 1980, C. Walters, A. Shimoyama, and C. Ponnanperuma examined Isopherla for evidence of photosynthetic activity. Their conclusion, we now have what we believe is strong evidence for life on Earth 3,800,000,000 years ago. These findings were supported in 1988 by Manfred Schidlowski of the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Germany, who published a paper in Nature interpreting the proportion of light carbon isotopes in the 3,800,000,000-year-old sedimentary rocks from Masu in Greenland as signs of early organic life. Schidlowski, I'm expecting anybody to remember the detail. All I want you to see is Mattias. The scientists absolutely refuse, and they must construct the theories to make their self-deceived, empty, vain theories work. And Schidlowski. Interpretation was confirmed in 1996 by Gustav Arrhenius of the Scripps Institute in San Diego, who examined the 3.8 billion year-old rocks from Masu and reported a mixture of carbon isotopes that only living things could produce. The meaning of these discoveries is unambiguously clear. If the first surface water formed 3,800,000,000 years ago, and the first microorganisms came into existence 3,800,000,000 years ago, then there was zero time available for the spontaneous appearance of life, one step of which was a chance of one in a billion. Life, it seems, did not wait for blind chance to roll the dice, but erupted in the first available instant, leaving Darwinists with no time at all for their probabilistic process. Zero time. Now, I said a biogenesis, how chemistry moves to life, they like to avoid. It just happened. It happened, it had to happen by evolution, because evolution is God, and therefore He made it happen, no matter what the probabilities. But let me go one step further. Not only was it one in a billion years, one chance in a billion years that a protein molecule would emerge by chance, what about life? The biogenesis, the appearance of life from inanimate matter, coming to being spontaneously in a primitive warm pool, as Fantasia said. Natural, chance, accidental, jump now from the proteins that have zero time to have one in a billion year chance to move from just chemical molecule to life. Information theory scientist Yaki, calculated the probability that a protein containing 100 amino acids would form spontaneously is only one chance in one with 65 zeros behind it. So now we have one in a billion years for the protein molecule chemically to spontaneously form. And for that to have an accumulation in the chain of molecules, I just showed you a complicated picture from Encyclopedia Britannica, to form by chance life, which nobody can test, but computer getting all of the elements and every possible combination of protein molecules and projecting it with a giant computer, they have come up with the chance of the right combinations coming together to form life, forgetting the information contained in that life, the pre-program, like what a programmer puts into a computer that tells all the cells exactly what to do, forgetting that, just the chance in a computer experiment of life spontaneously coming, 10 or 1 with 65 zeros. Backed up by Robert Sauer and his biologist colleagues at MIT, who experimented with rebuilding proteins by taking away amino acids and replacing them with other amino acids, like some chance operation going on. They found that some parts of a protein chain, I just showed you a picture of all those complications, some parts of a protein chain are tolerant to substitutions, other parts completely intolerant, showing the proteins are not arbitrary collections of component chemicals, but rare and sometimes unique combinations. Sauer and his colleagues confirmed Yockey's calculations by a reverse technique of pulling amino acids out of the protein molecule and experimenting with additions and all the possible combinations. They confirmed, same figures, the probability of a specific folded protein life coming into being by undirected evolution is 1 to the 1 with 65 zeros behind it. It's astronomical. You want me to give some substance? He gives it. You want me to give some substance to that chance? 1 in 1 billion years for a protein to form. By chance, 1 in 1 billion years. Well, give him a break and say, like hitting the jackpot with the first pull on a machine. That you got that. Well, there's less than a year because life was there, 3.8 billion, by the Greenland fossils. Now, within that, I mean, the first pull of the slot machine, evolution got a protein. Now, for that protein to become life with a proper combination of amino acids, 1 to 1 with 65 zeros. You know what the probability of that is? Winning the state lottery, but finding the winning ticket on the street, then continuing to win the lottery every week for 1,000 years, finding the winning ticket in the street each time. Primitive man, with none of the knowledge we now have, primitive man looked at the universe. Maybe he thought the earth was flat, I don't know. Primitive man looked and wrote Psalm 19. The heavens declare thy glory. The sun is a chariot and stands in awe before God. The earliest astrological charts did not have what has now become astrology. It started with Virgo the Virgin and ended with Leo the Lion crushing the serpent. The earliest worshipers were monotheistic, one God. Now science has pushed to the vast reaches of space, and the further they expand the circumference, the more the mystery, and the more there is to discovery, and the more the perfection. They've gone to the micro, and they jump off of a cliff into the uncertainty land, where they can no longer control it, as Hawking says, to be able to understand it is to have the mind of God and be master of it. They're into the vast unknown in quantum mechanics. Now, Darwinism rests, impossible to be maintained apart from, on a belief that the earth is 4,600,000,000 years old, because they need that much time for all this to happen. And they want to start out, I think Johnson's got a cute little replacement for Genesis, in the beginning were the particles. And the particles became complex living stuff. And the stuff imagined God, but then discovered evolution. Fools. One other thing I must read. God's replacement is in Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And as they push now into information theory and molecular biology, which Darwin has tried to retreat to when they were failing in other areas, they have no explanation for this. Life contains, I've already given you the staggering odds, haven't I? Well, that's just bland life, as though life is a blob. No, life comes on the scene full of information. It contains a distinct non-material component called information. Completely different. It's got a language all its own. It's like word. It is telling the cells what to do and how to do it. And it's built in. The minute life shows up, you have this word. As John says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. This is the one I wanted. Darwin on Trial by Philip E. Johnson. And I've ordered most of these for the bookstore in the weeks ahead, so don't work too hard to get them elsewhere. This is what's bugging everybody. After all, what impresses us about a living thing is its inbuilt ingenuity, its appearance. This is by a Darwinist who doesn't want to face this. Its appearance of having been designed throughout, of having been put together with a purpose. The singular feature is the enormous gap between the simplest conceivable versions of organisms as we know them and components that the earth might reasonably have been able to generate. But the real trouble arises because too much complexity seems to be necessary to the whole way in which organisms work. This is Karen Smith, the Darwinist, describes messages contained in the genetic information stored in the library of each cell's DNA. And even the Darwinist that I quoted earlier, calling this guy loony, he is on record with saying, The smallest molecule of life has information guiding it that if it would be translated into words would be as much or more than all 30 volumes of Encyclopedia Britannica. These molecules of life come on the scene with a vocabulary of intelligent communication, messages, programmed instructions, languages, information, coding and decoding, libraries. Well, now, we are trying to get artificial intelligence in computers. And computers can be made to become a dictionary. You just add the words, the inbuilt spell thing that you have for your computers. Covers most common words, but you can make it a spelling test on a daily basis as you add your new words to the program. It needs a programmer. Who's the programmer? And if it took enough time for this life to emerge, giving the break of 1 in a billion for amino acids to produce a chemical protein, and protein then to move to a life structure, finding a lottery ticket in the street that's the winning ticket and doing it every week for 1,000 years. And then when it occurs, how long did it take to, by chance, develop what lives on even when you die, the DNA structure? You are perpetuated by genes. And DNA identifies you. Crime is now using it, or crime finders. Who put that program in the cells? We dare not allow God to even get His foot in the door. We have decreed chance, accidental mutation, survival of the fittest, and a long time doing it is the way it happened, and there had to be an oxygen-free universe or Earth when it started, because that was what was required for it to happen, and it happened, and therefore that's what it was. 1 in 1 billion, but like a slot machine, it hit it on the first pull. 1 in 1 to the 65, 5. Impossible odds, but it happened so, and the only way we can allow it to happen is by chance mutation and long-time natural selection. 30 volumes of information, Encyclopedia Britannica style, in a cell, but that developed by chance. And I am supposed to be scorned because I believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, for which people gave their delight, their lives in testifying to eyewitness results. Matthias. Empty, vain babblings of those that are a tragedy to God's creation, who have prostituted their God-given abilities to their own ego and self-worship and ruled God out of the universe. And God decided, since He's ruled out, He will take the capacity to recognize Him from them and let them make fools of themselves, professing to be wise, and all the time demonstrating themselves to be morons. And the reason I'm preaching on it is to show you what morons they are, and thus prove the Bible in a reverse way. And that's my message for today. Make your reservations next Sunday, anniversary Sunday, Easter Sunday for us, and next Sunday night, April 8th, miracle service at King's House 1 at 7 o'clock, anniversary service here in the cathedral at 11. Make your reservations immediately today. Do that as a faithful testimony of commitment to your part in this ministry. Next Sunday is the resurrection message. The following Sunday, I'm going to show you the flaws in potassium-argon dating. There's a newspaper article. I can anticipate it. The system in 3 different studies varied from 500, 0.5, 0.5 billion years, or million years, to 17.5 million years in one study. Correction, 0.5 billion to 17.5 billion. That was the variation in the very areas that they dated this so competently. The time says was 3.5 billion years ago, or million years ago. I was right the first time. We're talking millions. I'll demonstrate it to you, put it on the board, show you the flaws of radiocarbon dating and the problems with radioactive dating and the potassium argon with half-lives of, I think it's 3 point something billion years. We'll be back on that a week from Sunday as I continue to expand Romans 1 and into the next 23rd and 24th verses. I hope you are gaining a faith in God from this series. I hope you'll bring friends that know how to act in the cathedral next Sunday as I give the annual message of the basis of our faith on the positive side. I want the song that we all should sing as the offering is taken. When the music's finished, you're dismissed. I'm so glad Jesus lifted me. We didn't sing it to start. I interrupted it. We're going to end with it. Good day, folks.